Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with purchase.
ES Audio.
Hello, I'm Nick Curtis, the Evening Standard's chief theatre critic. Welcome back to our theatre podcast. With me this week is Nick Clark, the Evening Standard's deputy culture editor. Hello, Nick.
Hi.
Coming up, we'll be looking at the world's longest-running show, The Mousetrap, which, Nick, you've been researching quite deeply this week.
Yes, and I'll tell you why it won't be coming to a cinema screen near you anytime soon.
Excellent. But first of all, we're kicking off with the revival of the musical From Here to Eternity at the Charing Cross Theatre. 30-year man, 30-year man. So first up this week, we have From Here to Eternity, the musical by Tim Rice and Stuart Brayson, based on the novel by James Jones. They're making it very clear that it's not based on the film, which I think most people will know From Here to Eternity for. It was only staged once before in London, back in 2013, I believe, then revived in America. This is the first London revival, and I think it's fair to say it's slightly different to your average enormous West End show.
Yes, well, Tim Rice was fairly clear, talking to The Stage recently, about the 2013 production was a bit of a flop, and it was in the Shaftesbury Theatre, a 1,400-seater, and that it was just too big, really. And they've gone completely opposite, so they've gone to the Charing Cross Theatre, 265 seats, and it feels so much more intimate, and that really worked for the production, I thought. You know, this was a good night at the theatre. I mean, we're going to talk about some of the issues probably at length, but I found that the Traverse setup, basically when the audience on both sides of the stage, really helped the staging really bring you into the story.
Yes, it makes it much more intimate. I mean, those sort of exposed stagings, they don't give them anywhere to hide. You can't do a sophisticated set. You can't do big effects. It's all about the music and the performances. And for me, it was the music that really worked rather than the performances.
I wouldn't say they were totally traditional musical songs. I don't know what that is. But what I don't think it is guitar ballads and some songs which actually I would have thought wouldn't look out of place on the set of a boy band. But what I've got to say is that they really had me humming along and tapping my feet. I came out, as many people around me did, saying quite how good the songs were. So basically, if you're coming out thinking the music was good, I think that's probably the hallmark of a good musical.
There's a famous old Broadway review, I think, about the audience came out whistling the set. We should probably say a little bit about the plot. It's set on a military base in Hawaii with two parallel romances running in the 2 weeks before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I think those who have seen the film will be quite surprised how camp this version is and how much of a gay subtext there is to it. How many of the sailors and soldiers on the base are involved going to sort of gay brothels and indeed going to straight brothels, which is something that didn't feature in the film and apparently was expurgated from the original novel. I gather an unexpurgated version was published, and that's what Rice based this on. It's interesting. Again, it's an untraditional musical, really.
It's about, essentially, people waiting to fight, waiting to be involved in the war. We, as the audience, know that very shortly they're going to be very involved, but they don't, and they spend most of the show, really, sitting around, getting increasingly tense, fighting, shouting. And the problem with that is there isn't a huge amount of jeopardy. I found that when I was watching it, there's a lot of talk about bugling. There's a lot of talk about boxing. The biggest jeopardy is whether Private Pruitt, the lead character, or one of the lead characters, is going to step up and fight for his regiment and get the colonel a promotion. And ultimately, I found myself not really caring about that.
Yeah. It's an extended metaphor, isn't it, for American complacency, I think, for them sleepwalking into war, them worrying about these sort of trivial matters, and then suddenly bombs start falling on them.
Yeah, you could definitely read it like that. I think There isn't a huge amount of subtext in this. It doesn't delve very deeply into the issues. If you were desperately looking for issues, you could talk toxic masculinity and what happens when young men are forced together with nothing to do. You could also look at various issues around the army and how the army, if it doesn't actively mistreat some of the young men, it abandons them. So there are some issues under the surface, but as I say, I wouldn't say they're dealt with hugely in any depth.
I tend to agree. What did you think about the two sort of central romances in it? We should maybe clarify that one of the sergeants is having an affair with the commanding officer's wife because they have a deeply toxic marriage, which she's desperate to escape from. Meanwhile, Pruitt, the bugler that we and non-boxer who we mentioned earlier, is having an affair with a prostitute. He's obsessed with her, isn't he? I mean, it's not really an affair. She's very clear that it's a professional transaction, but he is sort of besotted.
Yes, and it's clear that they have some knowledge of each other from beforehand, and he's the sort of the rogue character dropped into the plot to get it going. I think a bit of an issue with this is that neither of the romances really sparked. I don't think there was a huge amount of chemistry between either of the lead romances, and I've got to say that that's a bit of a problem for the plot. So when the denouement does happen, a series of events that take place, it's very hard to care about what happens in the final reckoning to that.
I think it's surprising how young the cast were for this, because the actors in the movie are fairly mature. They're in the sort of 30s and 40s. Here, they properly look like they could be 20-year-old lads. One of the two male leads who plays Warden, he's a sergeant, but his surname is Warden, looked like the sort of love child of Benedict Cumberbatch and Will Poulter, I thought. He was this incredible baby face.
I was just going to shout out a couple of other people in the show. One, I thought, actually, Eve Policarpu and her song, I Know What You Came For, was great. And another one, which I think might be a role that's rather divisive, but Johnny Ames, I hope I haven't butchered his name, he's playing Maggio, which is a character that really walks the line between being really funny and really annoying. And actually, I think he just about pulls it off on the right side of that line. So I thought he probably, as bringing life to the show, that he deserves a bit of a shout out too.
Yes, and while we're talking about shouting, I actually quite like the shouty Sergeant Galevich, played by Reese Nuttall. I mean, they're a whole subgenre of fiction, aren't they? The shouting sadistic sergeant, and I thought he was one of the best. So I would have I would say this is a 3-star show out of 5. Probably.
Absolutely.
It's solid. I think it's as you say, you come out sort of humming the songs. You're sort of vaguely rooting for the people in the lead, but not that deeply invested in them. So, you know, it's not an absolute blockbuster night out, but it's an interesting stripped back staging, which maybe reinvents it in a useful way, given that it failed first time round. You know, even Tim Rice said it failed first
time. Absolutely. And that intimacy of the staging, I think, really adds an extra layer to it too.
Right, let's go to the ads. In the second half, the world's longest running show, The Mousetrap. We'll be back after this.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
For our second show this week, we're considering The Mousetrap as it marks its 70th anniversary next week. Well, what's it about?
So 7 strangers find themselves snowed in at a country guest house. Essentially, at the beginning, it's a young couple who have just opened their guest house, worse luck, and these 7 strangers turn up. What, we've got to say, they're quite archetypal characters. There's not a huge amount of nuance behind them, but they're played with great verve by the actors, I think. And now, with a sort of a knowing nod to the lines, because I don't think they've really changed the lines very much. I hear there's been a cut here or there, but nothing much. So I think the way of doing it in 2022 has been to add a little bit of knowing yes. wink to the audience. But yeah, so as these seven characters start to interact, dark secrets emerge, and it emerges there is a killer in their midst, and they start vanishing.
Mm. Yes, it's interesting. The characters are sort of like Cluedo characters, aren't they? Except they probably predate Cluedo, I imagine. Yeah, Cluedo was ripping off the mousetrap rather than vice versa. But they are the sort of colonel, aren't they? And yes. the young couple, as you say. And
so Agatha Christie may have been the queen of crime, but she didn't get everything right, because her prediction in her diaries was that the mousetrap would run for 14 months. So 68 years off that one.
Yeah, wildly out on that one, I think. Nick, you've been talking to a lot of people involved, I believe.
Well, yes. So for the Evening Standard, we're looking at a feature covering 70 years of The Mousetrap, and really wondering, what is it about this show, this small radio sketch done by Agatha Christie all those years ago, that has become this extraordinary cultural phenomenon? What feels really interesting is that following the pandemic, when obviously there was an enforced hiatus, it really seems to be back stronger than ever. I was there last week. Audiences absolutely packed out. I think you were there recently as well. And again, also,
I went immediately after the pandemic because I had never seen it. I've been writing about London theatre in one capacity or another for over three decades. And not only had I never seen The Mousetrap, I'd never been inside the St. Martin's Theatre, because The Mousetrap has been running there since before I was born. It was a revelation for me to see it. It was quite an excitement because it was one of the first West End shows to reopen after the pandemic.
It was the first West End show.
It was the first West End show. And they reopened it then rather interestingly with two different sets of casts, I think, to sort of hit different demographics. So the cast I saw was very much stuffed with the sort of voices of my youth. So Derek Griffiths was playing the military man, and Hayley Mills was the older woman in it. And it was just sort of glorious.
And they'd star cast it, right?
Yeah.
Which is the first time since it opened, when it had Richard Attenborough,
yes,
in one of the lead roles,
yes,
and now they had Danny Mac and Cassidy Jensen and people,
yes,
like that.
That's right.
But the producer Adam Spiegel was really interested. I mean, they gave it a great spruce. The set looks great.
Yep.
The marketing looks much better, and they really lean heavily into the history now.
Yes.
Be part of the history. Get involved. Come along. Can you solve it?
Yep.
And I found that when I was there, there were selfies in front of the blue plaque outside. There's this board with all the number of performances that have taken place. So my night was 28,885. And I figure that must be the most selfied board in theatre land.
I think you're probably right. And they do, I think you get a programme and they stamp your programme with the performance,
absolutely,
number as well, which is, I think, was a lovely, charming thing, which I wasn't expecting. One of my predecessors, Nicholas de Jong, I seem to remember in the past, had a long-standing campaign to get them to let him in to re-review it, because they were still running the original review from 1952 from the Evening Standard outside. I can't remember whether he was successful or not. And I don't know how one would even review The Mousetrap now. I mean, if you were giving it a star rating, what would you give it?
I could give it anything from, well, 1 to 5, who knows? Take your pick. It's got too much baggage, really.
I think 70 stars,
yeah,
on its 70th anniversary, yeah, for The Mousetrap.
Absolutely.
I'm not usually into heritage theatre, but I was really quite pleasantly surprised by how dark it is, for one thing, that at its heart, it's a story of child abuse, or, you know, historically child abuse, that is what drives the plot. So, yes, I mean, I think it's good to be reminded of how radical Christie was in lots of ways.
Well, I think if we think back to when it opened in 1952, it was a contemporary play. If you think 70 years on, it is a heritage piece, but it speaks to some sort of nostalgic Britishness that maybe you can't get live anywhere else. But it goes out on tour around the UK and sells out there as well. So I think people who love David Suchet and Poirot would love this as well. I think,
yes,
it just keeps bringing people, whether domestically or internationally, because it looks back to a Britishness that actually Agatha Christie was writing contemporaneously.
Yes.
Which is very interesting. But if you think of how society's changed since then,
yes,
it's extraordinary that it survived.
I think its closest rival might be The Fantastics in New York, which I think has been running since the 60s. But that's still, you know, nothing to touch The Mousetrap, really.
And everyone's heard of it.
It's, yes.
I think the fact that Poirot isn't the protagonist, or Miss Marple isn't the protagonist, is actually good for the play, because the play is the thing. The name, people know the name of The Mousetrap.
Yeah.
If it was any number of Poirot, you wouldn't know which Agatha Christie it was, but you'd know that it was a Poirot. Yes. So I think there's something, everyone knows that Theatreland equal, or Mousetrap equals Theatreland, and Theatreland equals Mousetrap.
Really. And of course the lovely in-joke in it is the title comes from Hamlet. You know, the play that Hamlet puts to trap his uncle is called The Mousetrap in Hamlet, the play within the play. So I think, you know, Christie was operating quite often on many more levels than we sometimes give her credit.
Absolutely. You mentioned the darkness. I mean, she doesn't shy away from darkness in her novels. It's something that probably now... She is often seen as quite twee, again, because of her longevity, much as The Mousetrap has been. But actually, when you experience it firsthand, yes, you realise there are there are many more layers in it.
And it's become a sort of cultural icon now, hasn't it?
It has.
And it's never been filmed, which is extraordinary.
No, because there's a clause inserted into the rights for it that the film could only ever be made 6 months after the play closed.
Wow. That's amazing.
It's an extraordinary thing because it obviously gets referenced and pastiched all over the place. One that really sticks out to me is the Toast of London episode, The Moose Trap, in which, possibly referencing some years ago where the auditorium was half full and even the actors on stage were falling asleep, which I can tell you is not how it is now. But also See How They Run, which was a major film released this year, which is a pastiche on detective fiction Agatha Christie stories itself and is set within the world of The Mousetrap and a director who gets killed backstage. But it is not actually an adaptation of The Mousetrap because, as we know, they cannot make the film for 6 months after
and
it closes.
And one of the good things about them not making the film is that theoretically still nobody has revealed who the murderer is at the end. It's supposed to be the best kept secret in theatre land, certainly.
Absolutely. And we're going to stay stum.
We're going to stay stum. This has been the Evening Standard's Theatre Podcast. I'm Nick Curtis.
And I'm Nick Clark.
It's been great having you on the show.
It's been great being part of Theatre's second Nick and Nick partnership.
Excellent. Let's go forward. You can find us online at standard.co.uk/culture or hashtag The Leader Podcast on Twitter. The Leader Podcast will be back tomorrow from 4 p.m. and we'll see you again next Sunday for a brand new episode.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.